I was going to shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years. In front of Joe Pepitone. You know what that feels like? You can't know what that feels like, because no one has ever had to shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years in front of Joe Pepitone. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. Not in front of Joe Pepitone. I looked through the little hole in the stage wings again. He was reading his program. He was probably getting to the part where it said, "Voice of Bertha Mason, Douglas Swiatek." Any second now he was going to lean over to someone near him and point to my name. "Isn't that a guy?" he was going to say. "How can a guy play the voice of Bertha Mason?" Then he was going to look at my name again, and he was going to say, "You know, that name sounds familiar." And then he was going to think about it some more, and he'd say, "That name is so familiar." And then he was going to remember. Terrific. I looked around wildly. And suddenly, there were my mother and Mr. and Mrs. Spicer, and Mr. Gregory and Mrs. Windermere, and Lil, who was taking her turn looking like disaster. "We've got to get out of here," I said. Mrs. Spicer nodded. "We know. We know. We're going to take her to the hospital right away." "Her? Hospital?" "We think it might be the pencils," said Mr. Spicer. Lil smiled, sort of. She was holding on to her parents pretty tight. She'd been crying. "Break a leg," she said. She was still crying. "Break a leg," I said. "It's what is said to actors before they go on stage," said Mr. Gregory. "On stage?" I said. Lil tried to smile again. "Remember, Doug, it's sketch heard." I shook my head. "I'm not going on stage." My mother put both her hands up to her face. Mrs. Windermere came and stood beside me. She put one hand on my shoulder and another on my elbow. "Who else knows all the lines for Helen Burns?" she said. I looked at her. I looked at Mr. Gregory, at my mother, then Mr. and Mrs. Spicer, then Lil. "Break a leg," she said again, sort of weak. "He'll be fine," said Mrs. Windermere. "No," I said. "We've got to get you to the dressing room," said Mr. Gregory. "No, no," I said again. "You remember who is sitting in the audience? In the second row?" "You do know the lines, don't you?" said Mr. Gregory. "No," I said. "He's lying," said Lil. "If we were to tie his hair up into a bun, and some baby powder to make his face pale." "Baby powder! Did you know that Joe Pepitone is sitting out there?" "A great many people are sitting out there," said Mr. Gregory. Lil grimaced, but not because of Joe Pepitone. "I think we'd better..." The Spicers left. Lil's stomach was hurting so bad, she didn't even look back. Mr. Gregory and Mrs. Windermere took me to the dressing room. "This is what we have to work with," they said to a whole lot of people who began to smile at me a whole lot, and they weren't the kind of smiles that make you happy. "Listen," I said, "if this is just because of a stomach ache..." "Remember," Mrs. Windermere said, "people were starting to tie my hair up into a bun. Jane Eyre will walk across the stage and address you. You'll be reading a book on a bench. Jane won't speak to you until you turn the page. So don't forget to turn it. Then she'll say, 'Is your book interesting?' And you say, 'Skinny delivery boy.' You say, Nope. It stinks. Doug, said Mrs. Windermere. I say, I like it. And she says, what is it about? And I hand it to her and say, you may look at it. By this time, my hair was tied up in a bun. A tight bun. And someone was powdering the back of my neck. Could you go out there and tell Joe Pepitone to go home? I said. And when she says, do you like the teachers here at Lowood Institution? You say, they stink too. Mrs. Windermere looked at me, hard. They're all criminally insane. I think Mr. Gregory was about to start crying right there, even though it wasn't him that was getting his hair tied up in a bun, which, by the way, hurts. You have to get this right, Mr. Gregory said. And I think it was the have to that gave me the idea. Even as someone told me to raise my arms so she could slip a long Lowood Institution dress over me, which didn't exactly help the bun. Mrs. Windermere, I said, I know the part, but this changes things. What do you mean? I mean, Lil and I were getting the snowy heron for this, right? She nodded, a little suspicious. If I'm going to play Helen Burns in front of Joe Pepitone, then I want the red-throated divers, too. Mrs. Windermere opened her eyes wide. I mean, really wide. I've had those divers for years, she said. I waited. That wasn't part of our agreement. I waited. They're perfect over the mantle. They're perfect back in the book, I said. She shook her head. Absolutely not. Do you realize how much that plate costs? I waited some more. Agreed, said Mr. Gregory. There it was. Mrs. Windermere looked at him the way an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years would look at him. It's not your decision, Gregory, she said. It's my theater, it's my production, it's my reputation, and it's my money, said Mr. Gregory. He held out his hand. I shook it. I could use a bowl of lemon ice cream, said Mrs. Windermere. I'm not lying. I was a killer Helen Burns. I stepped out onto that stage like I was the great Eskimo Curlew. When Jane Eyre came to look at my book, which happens to be Our Town, I handed it to her just right. When Miss Scatcherd told me I never cleaned my nails, I was about as quiet and innocent as a large-billed puffin. When she hit me a dozen times with a bunch of twigs, I was the brown pelican. I didn't bat an eye. And you try getting hit a dozen times with a bunch of twigs. And when I had to die, people were crying. Really. And you know why? Because I was the black-backed gull. And so people cried like Helen Burns was their best friend. Maybe even Joe Pepitone was crying. Who knows? And Mr. Gregory was crying, too. Probably in relief. You should have heard the clapping as the curtain came down on dead Helen Burns. When I got to the wings, Mr. Gregory picked me up and hugged me and twirled me around and got baby powder all over himself, and I had to tell him to let me go since I was headed back to the dressing room because I wasn't going to be Helen Burns any longer than I had to, and was someone going to help me get this stupid bun untied? By the way, you can guess what my mother was doing in the wings. But the best part was still to come. Maybe it was because of the Helen Burns applause. Or maybe it was all the practice. Or maybe it was because Joe Pepitone was in the second row. But I let out the Bertha Mason shriek. And by the time the first echoes finished bouncing back from the mezzanine, I wasn't the only one in the Rose Theater who was shrieking. It was that good. I bet that everyone there really did think that there was an insane woman who had been locked in the attic of the theater for a great many years, and they had just heard her. I guess the rest of the play was all right. I spent some of it reading Our Town, and some of it working on the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States report, which was almost finished, even though a certain someone hadn't written a single word, and now she would probably say that she was so sick that she couldn't write a thing. Terrific. But I'm not lying. What I was thinking about more was a certain book, and certain missing pages, and bringing those pages back to a certain library, and handing them to a certain librarian, and me and Lil watching him put them back. I know what the red-throated divers are watching for. I know what the next spectacular thing is. By the time we got to the Reader, I Married Him, a quiet wedding we had, he and I, the parson and clerk, were alone present, part. It was almost 11 o'clock, and Mrs. Windermere still had to drive my mother and me back home, which meant it would be almost 1 o'clock before I even got close to sleep. But I didn't care. I'd finished laying the last transcontinental rail and pounded in the golden spike, and the audience was standing and hollering. And the next day, I'd be handing 2 Audubon prints to Mr. Powell. What could be better? Who cares if Mrs. Windermere was taking forever being the playwright out in the lobby? Who cares if she was holding my mother beside her like her new best friend? What could be better? And about then, Joe Pepitone came backstage. He really did. Joe Pepitone. Backstage. "Hey, kid," he said. I looked at him. Joe Pepitone. Doug, right? I nodded. Joe Pepitone. I threw with you last fall. You still got my cap? I nodded. Joe Pepitone. He laughed. A laugh that only Joe Pepitone could laugh. I saw your name in the program. So you were the guy who shrieked off stage. I nodded. You know, kid, you almost made me wet my pants. I laughed. He laughed. I tried to laugh like him. And you were Helen Burns, too. My heart stopped. You know what it means when your heart stops? It means that when you think that nothing could be better, right about then, it all falls apart. If you remember, I told you that a long time ago. I nodded. Yep, I said. He shook his head. Big smile. You were great, he said. You had me bawling, even though I knew it was you. Bawling, kid. He shook his head again. Man, he said. I wish I had your talent. You had the whole house tonight. Then he held out his program. I already have one, I said. He laughed again. It's not for you, kid. It's for me. I want you to sign it. He opened it up to where my name was. Right there, he said, and handed me a pen from his inside pocket like he had put it there on purpose, just so I could sign a program for him. So I did. And write something for Horace, too. he said. So I did. Here's what I wrote. For Joe and Horace, thanks. Your friend, Doug. Joe Pepitone took the program back and looked at it. Thanks for what? He said. Everything, I said. Mrs. Windermere drove us back home really late. But you might say that we were both more than a little happy, mostly because Mr. Gregory had called Jane Eyre a smash and told us it was going to have a long run, and so Mrs. Windermere was flying high. I was, too, but mostly because Mr. Gregory had promised that if I stayed on as understudy, he would find another actress, to play Helen Burns until Lil came back. Fine by me. And you know what Mr. Gregory had given me and was now rolled up in a long tube in the back of the car? My mother and Mrs. Windermere and I sang about living in yellow submarines the whole way back, through Manhattan, across the Whitestone, and all the way up to Marysville. Sometimes when you keep singing the same song again and again and again, it gets really boring, really, really boring. But not on that drive. It got funnier and funnier. So we finally had to stop singing around Middletown because I thought that Mrs. Windermere was going to drive off the road. That's how hard she was laughing. My mother was about crying. When we got back home, all the lights were on in the living room. We opened the door, and when we came in, Lucas and Christopher were there, sitting and looking at us. How did it go? Christopher said. Fabulous. I told them about Joe Pepitone. I told them about the shrieking. And I even told them about playing Helen Burns, which I hadn't intended to tell them. We know about Helen Burns, said Lucas. How? I said. Lucas looked down. Mrs. Spicer called a little while ago, said Christopher, from a hospital in the city. Did she tell you that Lil got a stomachache from eating her pencils? I said. My mother took my hand. Little brother, Lucas said, it isn't a stomachache. And the yellow shank finally walked into the full dark. Chapter 10. The Arctic Tern. Here is the stat that the doctors gave Mr. and Mrs. Spicer. 1 in 4. That's the last stat I'm going to give you, because so what? So what? Stats don't mean anything. Every time Joe Pepitone steps up to the plate, it's new. It doesn't matter if he's hit 500 home runs or if he's struck out 500 times. It's a new thing. And no one can predict what's going to happen, except that he's Joe Pepitone, and he's going to try his darndest. And he's not going to let anything get him down. And he's going to fight his way through no matter what. And he's got all his friends behind him. And if you don't think that matters a whole lot, then you don't know how to get from first base to second. Because stats don't mean anything. On the first Saturday of June, I got to Spicer's Deli early, since I figured Mr. Spicer would need my help because Lil wouldn't be there to load the wagons. I was right. When I got there, the first wagon wasn't even close to loaded. Mr. Spicer was standing in the back, one hand holding the orders, the other messing up his hair. I can do that, I said. Lil usually does it, Mr. Spicer said. I know. I took the lists from his hand. Doug, he said, I'm going to have to let you go. The hospital bills, you can't believe what they're going to be. I don't have enough to pay you anymore. I don't have anything else to do on Saturday mornings, I said.
I know. What a chump.
But Mr. Spicer, he looked at me a long time. Then he nodded, hand back to hair. He went out front. I loaded the first wagon. At Mrs. Mason's house, she handed me an envelope with the money for the groceries and another $20. For the little girl, she said. Mr. Leffler was waiting for me with a glass jar full of yellow tulips.
Will you see the little girl sometime soon? He said. Would you mind?
And he handed me the tulips. All the Daugherty kids were waiting for me when I got to their house, sitting on the front stoop. They were all holding pictures they had drawn, of Lil getting better. In Ben's, she was jumping over a fence. In Polly's, she was riding her bike with a stupid basket in front of the library. In Joel's, she was flying over Washington Irving Junior High School. In Davy's, she was reading a huge stack of books under a tree. And in Phronsie's, she was kissing someone.
Who is she kissing? I said.
They all started to giggle. Me, I was almost a chump. Almost bawling in front of kids. At Mrs. Windermere's, she was waiting too. She opened the door into the kitchen, and we put the groceries away. And I asked how the play was going, and she said it was going fabulous. And I asked about the girl Mr. Gregory got to replace Lil, and she said she was fine, but not nearly as good as Lil. And I asked about the shrieking, which I wasn't doing anymore, since if I was going down to New York City, it wasn't to be in a play. And Mrs. Windermere said someone else was doing it now. She wasn't sure who. Then she asked about Lil. I was a chump. When I got back to the deli, Mr. Spicer was bawling beside the cash register. Just bawling. And not even trying to hide behind the flowers that were lined up in pots on the counter. All orchids. We were both chumps. But you know what? It's not so bad when you're chumps together. At the library, Mr. Powell had spread one of my sketches of the Arctic Tern out on a table. One of the big sketches, as big as Audubon's. I thought we might try to work with some watercolors today, he said. Perhaps we could start with the background. A box on the table held maybe 16 circles of paint and a bottle of water. Mr. Powell, I said, we'll mix the colors until we get them right. Mr. Powell, we don't have the Arctic Tern plate anymore. How will we know? We have what we remember, he said. I sat down. I looked across the room to the table where Lil usually was sitting. It will be a surprise for her, said Mr. Powell. He dipped the brush into the bottle. Let's get the color of the water first. He swirled his brush in one of the blues, then handed it to me.
What do you think? He said.
It looks like a color from New Zealand, I said. Let's see what happens if you start mixing them together, a little bit at a time. So I tried mixing them together. A little bit at a time. And here's what happened. The right color came. We both saw it at the same moment. Exactly the right color of the cold, smooth, frothy, deep water below the Arctic Tern. Not at all like New Zealand. Now draw your brush evenly along the line. Right. Right. Keep on. Now, let the brush up from the paper. Right. Dip your brush again,
and start back at the top. Draw down, down. No, it's all right. Let the paint suggest the texture. Down, down, and again. That afternoon, I painted in two of the waves behind the Arctic Tern.
How many times did you mess it up? Said Lil.
None.
Doug, you are such a liar.
You'll see it when you get back home. Then we were quiet, because we didn't know when that was going to be. And I'm not lying. You wouldn't want to be where Lil was for very long.
If you took the blue paint for the waves and added some green to make it look like puke, that would be the color of the walls, and the tiles on the floor, and the curtains by the window, and the tube that led from a dripping bag into a needle that got stuck in Lil's arm somewhere underneath the tape.
Does it hurt? I said.
How do you think a needle stuck up in your arm would feel? She said.
I think I'd start shrieking like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years.
That's what it feels like, she said.
Do you want me to shriek for you? I said.
She thought about that.
That might help, she said. You really do shriek pretty good. But then they might kick you out.
I didn't shriek.
She held out her hand, and I took it.
I loved playing Helen Burns, she said. I just don't want to be Helen Burns.
You can sit down on the bed, you know. It's not going to break,
at least not because of a skinny thug like you.
I thought, I'm not going to break either. 1 in 4, and I'm the one. I sat down on the bed. When all this is over, she said, we're going to Broadway and see Jane Eyre. And then we're going to the top of the Empire State Building. And after that, we're going to see the dinosaurs at the Museum of Natural History. And then we're going to walk down Fifth Avenue like we own it. A nurse came in.
It's time to draw some blood, honey. Just a little poke.
And afterward, we'll go to Central Park, and you can sketch people and charge them $5 a drawing. And then we'll take the money and find a French...
Oh!
She squeezed her eyes shut. A French restaurant, and eat stuff that we can't even pronounce.
Just a few more minutes, the nurse said to me. She's tired, so just a few more minutes.
Lil opened her eyes. Someday I'm going to live in New York City, she said.
I'm pretty happy in Marysville, I said.
Lil opened her eyes really wide, and maybe I did the same, because it kind of surprised me, too.
But it was true.
It really was. I was happy in Marysville. I didn't even know it until I said it, but it was true.
We'll find a way to compromise, Lil said.
No, we won't. We'll live in Marysville.
Her eyes started to close.
You are such a jerk.
She yawned.
It's cold in this room.
You can lie down if you want, and get under the blanket.
That's what I did.
She had to scoot over a little, and that wasn't so easy because she was attached to so much stuff. And we had to move the tube going into her arm so that I wouldn't lie down on it. That wasn't so easy either. But we hurried, because we knew we had only a few minutes before the nurse came back. And I lay down next to Lil, and I put my arm around her and felt her relax into me. And when she spoke, it was only in a whisper.
Doug, she said, I sure hope I'm the one in four.
You are, I said.
Who says?
Me.
A long silence. I thought she was almost asleep. Then, all right, she said. And that's when I knew. I knew that she was going to be all right. Don't ask me how, but I knew. I'm not lying. Not about this. Not ever about this. Stats don't mean anything, but some things mean everything. And that June, those things that mean everything, they kept coming, faster and faster. On the second Saturday, after my deliveries, Lucas was waiting for me in front of the Marysville Free Public Library. I could tell he'd been out looking for work all morning. He had this tired, beat-up look, and it wasn't hard to figure out what he'd been hearing. I'm sorry, son. Nothing for you today. I don't think you could handle it. Don't waste my time. You'd look tired and beat up, too, if you'd been hearing that. So you want me to pull you up the steps? I said. He looked at me, and his face got hard for a second, like the old Lucas. But not exactly like the old Lucas. You don't think I can do it myself? Lucas. You don't think I can handle it? I think you can handle anything, I said. Darn right, he said. Darn right I can handle anything. He turned around and backed his wheelchair toward the six steps. Then he looked over his shoulder, leaned back, and pulled up on the front of the left wheel. Then he leaned back even more, and I'm not lying, the wheelchair started to go up the first step. Kind of crooked, but up. And then he began to fall over. I started toward him. But he leaned forward and caught it. And he had the left wheel up on the first step. Then he leaned again and pulled up on the right wheel. And with a heft, there he was, on the second step, balanced. He looked at me, sweating. What do you have that goofy grin on your face for? He said. Do it again, I said. He backed up to the next step, leaned back, hefted up, sweated. Not bad, I said. The third step, and he almost went over that time, but he caught himself and leaned forward a little bit more. And then the fourth and fifth. And then he drew himself back to the sixth and grunted and pulled and came back down onto the fifth. No. Stay put, little brother. I did. You would have, too. He backed up again, waited for a moment, leaned to the left and pulled up, squeezing his eyes tight, and brought the chair half up. Then leaned to the right, squeezed his eyes again, and so came over the last step of the Marysville Free Public Library. He was breathing a little bit heavily. So was I. Not bad, I said. It's all in the balance, Lucas said. You were a little slow. I'll practice. That smile. Then the library door opened, and out came, and you're not going to believe this, but it was June, and as true as true, out came Coach Reed from the library. I'm not lying.
Pretty good, he said to Lucas.
Thanks, said Lucas.
It would take a lot of strength to pull yourself up like that,
I guess,
said Lucas.
I guess,
said Coach Reed. He looked at me.
Your brother?
I nodded.
Jack Reed, he said to Lucas.
Then he held the door of the library open so that Lucas could wheel himself through. Lucas probably didn't want him to, but after a day of trying to fit your wheelchair through the doors of places that didn't want you, he might have been glad to have someone hold the door. I looked at Coach Reed as I went through. He looked back at me. I went on in and over to the elevator.
Hey,
Coach Reed. Lucas stopped and slowly spun himself around. And you know what? He looked like he was going to be okay. He might be tired and beat up, but he was going to be okay. That's what he looked like. And it was June. I bet Arctic terns fly strong in June.
I hear you've been looking for a job, said Coach Reed. That's right,
old Lucas' voice.
Any luck?
Yeah, said Lucas. Yeah, lots of luck. Everyone around here says that a guy in a wheelchair is just the kind of guy they've been looking for. I'm trying to decide between, I don't know, 8 or 9 offers.
Sounds tough.
Lucas started to spin around again.
Maybe you could come work for me, said Coach Reed.
He really said that. June. But Lucas didn't believe him.
Funny, Lucas said. Really funny. You ought to be on stage. You could make a living telling guys with missing legs jokes. They're not as funny as guys with missing arms jokes, but maybe you could come up with some of those too.
I'm not kidding. Lucas wheeled himself closer. Still old Lucas.
So what do you want me to do? Coach track? Maybe the high jump? Or the pole vault? I'm a heck of a pole vaulter.
Coach Reed looked at me, then back at my brother.
Maybe track. Maybe gymnastics. I saw you come up the stairs. Maybe weight training. I have a feeling you might be able to do a whole lot of things that you don't think you can.
How do you know? Coach Reed looked at me again.
Because I was there too.
Long silence.
I need an assistant, said Coach Reed. Then maybe you better find someone who... Assistant junior high school gym coach. There are 2 weeks left in this school year. If you started now, you could get your feet wet and be ready for September. If you notice, I don't have any Monday morning, 7 o'clock in the morning. We're beginning the last basketball unit. If you're there, the job is yours. That is, if you think you can keep a bunch of junior high kids from pulling any funny business on you.
I won't be there, said Lucas. Coach Reed looked at me.
Yes, sirree, Buster, I said. He'll be there.
All right, Coach Reed said, and went on down the steps.
I think I could have kissed him.
Lucas looked at me.
I'm not going to take a job I can't do.
You're right, I said. I don't think you can handle it. Lucas stared, like the old Lucas was going to say something. But the old Lucas didn't. Instead, Lucas nodded, and his face got all set and determined. And then he started to smile. He spun his chair around. Mrs. Merriam walked up. She had her glasses on, so she didn't look so loopy. Lucas laughed. He laughed.
Can I help you? She said to him.
I think I'm fine, he said.
We took the elevator upstairs. Lucas didn't mind the steel gate that we had to draw across. And he didn't mind the way the elevator rattled around on its way up. And he didn't mind the sound of the pulleys straining themselves. And he didn't mind that at the top, the elevator stopped a couple of inches below the floor. He jerked his chair up and pulled himself over the lip. At the table where Lil usually worked, Mr. Powell was mixing watercolors.
"You're late," he said.
"Lucas had a job interview," I said.
"For what position?"
"Assistant junior high school gym coach," said Lucas. "We start a basketball unit on Monday. And you know what? I'm not lying." Mr. Powell didn't seem surprised at all.
"Make them do free throws," he said. "Free throws discipline the mind and the eye and the hand. There's nothing like them."
Lucas laughed. "So good.
Sounds like you know what you're talking about."
Mr. Powell raised an eyebrow.
"I'm a librarian," he said. "I always know what I'm talking about.
Mr. Swiatek, does this gray look right?" We went over to the table which, you might remember, my Arctic Tern was on top of. "Who drew this?" Lucas said. He didn't need to lean down so close anymore.
"Your brother," said Mr. Powell.
Lucas touched the edge of the paper. "It's a copy," I said.
"My brother?" said Lucas.
He leaned forward. "It looks like he's flying off the page." "He's falling into the water," I said. Lucas shook his head.
"No, he's not.
He's going wherever he wants to go."
"Exactly right," said Mr. Powell,
and he handed me a paintbrush. "You know what it feels like to stroke color onto an Arctic Tern flying off the page, going wherever he wants to go? Terrific." It was June, you remember. On Monday, Lucas left the house before I did, by himself, heading to Washington Irving Junior High School. I went down to the gym between periods to watch him practice free throws from his chair. The stats weren't so good, but if you remember, stats don't mean anything. During lunch, which I had again, I watched Lucas run basketball drills. And at the end of the day, he was gathering up loose basketballs when I came in, and James Russell was calling out, "Coach Swiatek!" You think Lucas wasn't smiling when he heard that? You think I wasn't smiling when I heard that? I waved, and Lucas waved, and I went into Coach Reed's office. He had the presidential physical fitness charts spread out, and he was going through each one with his finger on the lines. He paused and looked up at me. "Thanks," I said.
"Go home," he said.
June. Somehow the message had gone out to all the teachers that the last 2 weeks of school were the last opportunity to bury the students of Washington Irving Junior High in work. Every other school in the country was getting ready for campouts and parties to celebrate the end of the year, but not us. In world history, Mr. McElroy was starting the causes of World War I. You know how many causes there were for World War I? No wonder they fought. In English, Miss Cowper said we were going to finish the year with selections from John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie, which didn't sound bad because Charlie is a dog and how bad could a dog story get? And it wasn't bad, except we had to keep notes about Steinbeck's technique because we were going to be writing our own travel accounts, fictional or non-fictional, for the year's final composition. Doesn't that sound all fired exciting? In advanced algebra,
Mrs. Verne told us that she was going to end the year with an introduction to geometry, and when we pointed out that geometry wasn't taught until 10th grade, she congratulated us on our powers of observation and told us all to be sure to bring protractors the next day. In P.E., we were practicing free throws. Every day, lots of free throws, because they were supposed to discipline the mind and the eye and the hand. I didn't complain to the coach. In physical science, Mr. Ferris announced that NASA had given the go-ahead, and in just a month, Apollo 11 would blast off to the moon. "This is what happens when you dream dreams," he said. He couldn't stop smiling, not even when he was describing the thermodynamics of the fuel for the Saturn rocket that would carry the command capsule and the LEM. Otis Bottom asked if we were going to make some fuel to see if it would explode. Even then, Mr. Ferris could not stop smiling. In geography, we had gotten all the way over to France, and Mr. Barber started us on maps of France under Louis XIV, or maybe it was the 15th, and we were supposed to copy all the important rivers and mountains and cities and towns and underline places that Louis XIV or 15th had visited according to Geography, the Story of the World. I'm not lying. The map that I drew was something that you would stop to look at. Audubon himself would have stopped and whistled, which is just what Mr. Barber did. Then he crouched next to me, and the scent of his coffee steamed up. "Douglas, did you trace that?" "Nope." "And those seagulls?" "I thought they would add realism." "They're fantastic," Mr. Barber said. "Thanks," I said. He whistled again. Then he stood up and took a step. You know one thing that Mr. Powell taught me? He taught me that sometimes art can make you forget everything else all around you. That's what art can do. And I guess that's what happened to Mr. Barber, who forgot that his left foot was behind the back leg of my chair. Who took a step without remembering to take his foot away from the back of my chair. Who tripped, but caught himself. But who couldn't catch the coffee that flew out of his cup, swirled around in the air for a second, and finally splashed down all over my geography, the story of the world, and started to soak into the pages as fast as it could. I won't tell you the sound that Mr. Barber made. It was something like the shriek an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years would make. My father hadn't said a word to me, or much to anyone, since I'd seen Ernie Echo wearing Joe Pepitone's jacket. He wouldn't even look at me during supper, which was fine, just fine. My mother covered the silence with talk about orchids, and Lucas couldn't stop talking about his job if someone had threatened to bloody murder him if he said another word. "They call me Coach Swiatek," he said. "Can you believe that? Coach Swiatek." "Even if you can't shoot a free throw worth diddly," said Christopher. 75% from the free throw line," Coach Swiatek said, which is a stat that he was probably stretching really far. I mean, really far. "That's something you dreamed, you mean," said Christopher. "Chris, why don't you open your mouth, look up to the ceiling, and we'll see how many of these carrots I can make from here." "Lucas," said my mother. "It's all right," said Christopher. "I'm not going to do it." He'd probably get them all in just for spite. "Isn't that right, Coach?" "Absolutely." My mother started laughing. You know how good it is to see my mother laugh? My father left the table. My mother stopped laughing. Lucas began eating his carrots. Christopher held his fork still over his plate.
"Isn't the orchid delicate in this light?" said my mother. June. A week before Christopher's hearing, which the town of Marysville was taking its time setting up, probably to make him sweat, my father stopped eating supper with us. He'd fill a plate in the kitchen before we started and then go into the bedroom. He didn't come out afterward. So what? So what? No one cared. Except maybe my mother. None of us talked about the hearing. None of us talked about what might happen. None of us used the word jail. Would you? Except at the hospital. At the hospital, I could talk about it.
"You know that your brother didn't break into the stores, right?" said Lil.
I nodded.
"You're sure?"
"I'm sure." Lil looked at me kind of slantwise.
"Then he didn't do it, and everything will be okay."
"Thank you, Judge Spicer."
"You're very welcome. So get out of your funk before I throw my bedpan at your head."
"Lil." But back at home, none of us talked about it. And meanwhile, I saw my father less and less, and whenever I did see him, he was sort of unstable. It's hard to say how exactly he looked like this. Maybe because of the way he stood, with his hands in his pockets, his eyes looking anywhere but at you, and bent over like he was hurting. Until the day before the hearing, when he came home from work late. He opened the door. I was helping Lucas with his weights in the living room, and he came in. He was carrying Joe Pepitone's jacket. It looked about as heavy as Lucas's weights. My mother came out from the kitchen. My father handed Joe Pepitone's jacket to me, his eyes looking away. Then he went into the bedroom. My mother followed him. When they came out, they went into the kitchen and they put food on the table together. My father looking so out of place carrying a bowl of mashed potatoes. Then my mother sat down in her chair, and he sat down in his. And when my mother didn't speak, Lucas started to talk about this new drill he had come up with for dribbling around cones and then going to a layup. And my mother and father and all of us filled our plates with mashed potatoes and green beans and a pork chop each. And Lucas and Christopher and me, we started to eat. But my father sat in front of his full plate, and my mother sat in front of hers, and they didn't eat. Not a bite. And Lucas talking about dribbling, and my mother and father looking at their full plates. The whole meal, they never said a word. Everything was quiet, except for Lucas. Then someone knocked at the door. My father looked at my mother, and my mother looked at my father.
"Could you answer that, Chris?"
said my mother. And when Christopher got up to answer the door, my mother stood and walked over to his seat, sat down, and took my father's hand. Christopher came back in. Behind him, Mr. Daugherty, in uniform. "Evening, folks," he said. "Sorry to bother you at dinner." He seemed huge in the house. Or maybe it was his uniform that seemed huge. If he sat down in one of our kitchen chairs, he would probably have broken it into pieces, he was that huge.
"Hello,"
said my mother, and stood up.
"Hello, Mrs. Swiatek," said Mr. Daugherty, and he nodded his head. He looked at me. "The kids all say hello, Doug."
"Tell them I said hi," I said.
"I'll do that."
He turned to Lucas.
I heard about the job, Coach.
Can you guess what Lucas looked like when huge Mr. Daugherty called him Coach?
Then Mr. Daugherty looked at my father and nodded.
Mr. Swiatek, he said.
My father nodded back, looking at my mother, never taking his eyes off my mother.
Can you tell that not a single one of us knew what to say?
My mother coughed a little bit.
Would you like a pork chop? She asked.
Can you tell that my mother really did not know what to say?
They look good, but I'd better not, said Mr. Daugherty.
I'm late for supper as it is, and you know what the missus will say if I can't eat a bite of what she's been cooking.
He cleared his throat. Twice.
Christopher, he said.
The hearing isn't till tomorrow, said Lucas.
You shouldn't.
There isn't going to be any hearing, said Mr. Daugherty.
There is no noise in space.
Did you know that?
If one of the Apollo 11 astronauts decides to go for a walk around the space capsule, he won't hear a thing. There's no sound at all. Sort of like in our house for about the next minute.
Then my father stood up.
Chris, he said, and stopped.
Try it again.
Chris?
We got an anonymous tip, said Mr. Daugherty. We found all the stuff from the hardware store, everything. And the guy confessed. To that, and to the break-in at Spicer's Deli last fall.
My mother got up and stood close to my father.
The Marysville Police Department would like to apologize to you, Christopher, said Mr. Daugherty.
Chris, said my father,
the tip was anonymous. And as far as the investigating officer, who is me, is concerned, the case is closed. There won't be any more charges.
My mother took my father's hand again.
And I'm sure, said Mr. Daugherty, I'm really very, very sure that the person who phoned in the tip knows now that getting involved with something like this could wreck a whole lot of people's lives. Not only his.
I'm sure he does, said my mother.
She went behind my father and put her arms around his chest. My father reached up and held on to her hands.
And I'm sure he has a terrific family, and he never meant to hurt them.
I'm sure he knows now that they're all he really needs.
He knows that, too, said my father.
Mr. Daugherty nodded.
I'm sorry again, Christopher.
If there's ever anything I can do for you.
Thanks, said Christopher.
See you Saturday, Doug.
See you then.
He turned and was gone.
And you know what?
The house was bigger. I'm not lying. It was like he left his hugeness behind him, and we had more room.
And you know what else?
It wasn't the dump anymore. It seemed, I don't know,
maybe I'm just a chump.
We all sat back down. We all looked at our cold mashed potatoes and cold pork chops, and we were all hungry. We started digging in like we hadn't eaten for a week, Christopher especially, and you can probably figure out why. Everyone eating and laughing at how fast we were eating and eating even faster, mashed potatoes flying, Lucas belching and Christopher belching and me belching and my father belching. My father, who sat back in his chair when there was no more food on the table, who looked around at us, and who said,
Isn't that orchid the most beautiful